Well, Jack, it's been kind of a biblical week for us here at the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. There's been floods, and we had a gas leak in our building the other day, and our computers quit working. It's been quite an interesting week. But as I'm sure you're aware, and everyone's heard, the courthouse flooded.
Right.
And the courthouse is going to be closed until further notice. We've had to move all of our hearings and things elsewhere. We had the grand jury meet in our office.
Is that a first?
As far as I am concerned, it is.
Yeah.
I've been there almost 17 years, and they've never come to our office. But we're rolling with the punches. I wanted to say that today's court day for us, and our hearings are going to be in the district courthouse and in the federal courthouse, and we're all kind of interested to see how that turns out.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the judges are coordinating all this, but I can't imagine what the clerks and the staff people are going through, moving files and taking things out of that courthouse. The place has been surrounded by trucks all week. They've got the hoses and those big giant tubes going in and out of the
right.
house.
I saw that in the paper.
It'll be quite an interesting couple of weeks.
And so, you say it could be 3 weeks or could even be more, huh?
Kind of the rumor we're hearing is about 3 weeks.
Mm. Okay,
So I hope our production values aren't off too much. We'll do our best this morning.
The show goes on.
It sure does.
And you brought a couple of veterans of this show with you.
I did. We're going to talk about a guy named Bradford Livers, and Mr. Livers is a gentleman that we've worked with quite a bit over the years.
Now, when you say worked with?
He has been a criminal defendant numerous times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to say up front, in the most polite and professional way that I can, that Mr. Livers has several family members that we have worked with as well over the years.
All right.
I brought Tracy Kinnear with me.
Hi, Tracy.
Morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Tracy hired in about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, I think, before I did. So we've been working together for quite
long
some time.
Yeah.
We have both interacted with the Livers family over the years.
Okay.
And Aspen Carlisle is here. She's one of our bright, young, rising stars in
Aspen,
the office.
Aspen, good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Thanks for coming.
And as far as I know, this was her introduction to the Livers family.
It was.
So they had a trial, an assault case that involved Bradford Livers and an elderly victim who was severely injured. And what we'd like to talk about today, of course, the resolution of the case is important, but this is a case that went to trial and resulted in a mistrial. The judge did not let the jury make a decision in this case, and the judge made some decisions specifically about the evidence that she allowed in or did not allow in that changed the way that these prosecutors approached the case. And I always talk about Law and Order or CSI. You know,
right.
On television, it takes the police 29 minutes to catch somebody, and it takes the prosecutors 29 minutes to try them.
Exactly.
And they play the commercials, and everybody's happy. In the real world, it's not really quite that easy, and it's never resolved that quickly. So I've asked these prosecutors to come today to talk about the effects of the judge's decisions on their presentation of the case and how the case was ultimately resolved.
Good.
So I guess we'll jump in first. We want to talk about the facts of this case. This happened, I believe, in December of 2011, and I guess I'll ask Aspen to talk about the underlying facts, what Mr. Livers did that brought him to the attention of the police and ultimately into our office.
It did. It happened on December 11th of 2011, and the victim, Marvin Jones, was a 64-year-old man. He had pulled up to a friend's house, and the defendant, Bradford Livers, was at that house, saw Mr. Jones pull up, and on his own accord just got in the passenger seat of the car. Mr. Jones was familiar with Bradford, knew he was bad news, didn't want him in his car, said get out. He got out of the car himself, and for some unknown reason, Bradford came around the car and just absolutely pummeled Mr. Jones.
Don't know why?
No, it was never really clear exactly what happened. I don't know if he was just upset because Mr. Jones wouldn't give him a ride or what
it
was.
I do have to take a little issue with the reference to Mr. Jones at 64 as elderly.
That was Dan's doing.
Dan, we're going to have to talk about that. But
well, it's a tactic we use to appeal to juries.
Okay, all right, good. But anyway, so he began beating this victim, and as I understand it, to the point where the victim was actually unconscious?
He was on the ground, and witnesses saw Bradford continue to beat on him. And in all fairness, Mr. Jones had had some health issues prior, so he was a little bit older than his years.
Okay.
And this just caused all sorts of problems. He ended up with a fractured jaw, bilateral facial fractures, meaning both cheekbones were fractured, his eye socket was fractured, and bones in his nose were fractured. When all was said and done, he had 12 titanium plates put in his face, and they'll be there forever.
Wow. And you said there were some folks who saw this.
A couple.
Okay.
So a couple. One that actually saw it. So he was really our only witness to it. And he was inside the house, had come outside, and then went back inside to call 911.
So he's the one that called the police.
Yes.
When the police arrived, was it over? Or was it still going?
Bradford had already left. Mm-hmm. So it took a day or two. That night. I think they caught up with him that night.
Okay.
But it wasn't instantly.
All right. And what happens then? They charge or what happens when the police find him?
They charged him at that point. So he was arrested on assault first. And later it came to light that they were actually, I think, talking with Mr. Jones's brother at the hospital and said, hey, he was missing some rings. He usually wore rings on all of his fingers and some were missing. They went back and spoke with the witness again, and he said, yes, while Mr. Jones was laying on the ground, Bradford went through his pockets and pulled things off his fingers, as well as a necklace.
Well, can you explain, as far as assault in the first degree is charged, one of the elements of that is a serious physical injury. Did that become an issue as this case went through the system?
It certainly became an issue. I think that's something Tracy wants to talk about.
Well, it was a big issue in this case because while there are injuries that to the common person certainly seem serious, I mean, this man's face was pretty much completely obliterated and had to be reconstructed. That sounds serious to any of us.
Sure.
But the legal definition of serious physical injury is actually quite difficult to prove because you have to be able to prove that they had a substantial risk of death. That's one of the elements. Or prolonged disfigurement. And in this kind of case where he got good health care, the way Mr. Jones looks today, he looks perfectly fine.
Oh.
He has 12 titanium plates in his face, but he looks fine. So we couldn't prove prolonged disfigurement. So then it became a question of, did he have substantial risk of death? Well, along with these injuries, he did have some very serious issues upon immediate arrival of EC. They were really concerned about him choking to death on his own blood. They had to insert a tracheotomy right there on the scene because they were concerned of him literally choking on his own blood.
Did he lose a lot of blood, too, or not?
Yes. I mean, it was a pretty gruesome scene.
Yeah.
And then another issue became once he got to the hospital, because after he went to the hospital, I think Ms. Carlisle had alluded to the fact that he had prior health issues. He had had strokes in prior years, and he suffered a very severe stroke just days into his hospital stay. And so if we could have proven that the assault actually caused or brought the onset of this new stroke, that could have been another element as well. But that became a big issue at the trial.
So when you're faced with a medical problem like this, how do you go about, just as a tactical decision, deciding on what records or what witnesses or how you're going to prove this in front of a jury?
I mean, we meet with a lot of doctors.
We met with a team of doctors in this case. And they review the records and all that?
A lot of it is almost in a different language to me. So they're able to go through and explain, well, this means this, these are the risks of this, these are the complications of this, and all of that sort of stuff.
So how many different doctors? I guess you start with the emergency room doctor and work
from there.
Started
with the emergency room. We went to several different neurologists, and I think there was some physical therapists. It took him about a year to actually fully recover. Well, still not fully recovered, but be able to feed himself and walk again. And so there's just a whole line of people that treated
him. Now, you mentioned that the rings were taken. That's a different charge, right?
So
that doesn't have anything to do with this first charge.
No, that's a separate charge of robbery.
Yeah, okay. And he was charged with that, too, I assume, right?
Yes.
It was added.
Okay. So what happened? I mean, what happened in terms of the charge?
So we've got these two serious felony charges. I guess the question is, how did you decide on who to call as witnesses to present this case when it went to trial?
Well, at the initial trial, I had just jumped into the case because we had a prosecutor that the original prosecutor had left our office. And so I jumped into the case. And the ER doctor was the one that was subpoenaed. And as the trial went on, again, the more lasting issue for Mr. Jones was the stroke. As Aspen said, he literally was at Cardinal Hill for several months after he got out of the hospital and then was at a rehab facility for up to a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that aspect of the case was far more had a far bigger impact on him than even the facial injuries. I mean, those were fixed in the first few weeks with surgeries and life went on. But for us, the big point of proof initially in the trial was all of that aftercare, all of that he went through in that year, because to us, the stroke was the biggest issue on serious physical injury.
We're going to take a break. If you have a question or comment, 253-5959. We're talking about a local assault case with Assistant Commonwealth Attorneys Dan Laren, Tracy Kinnear, and Aspen Carlisle. Dan, take it.
Well, we're talking about trial preparation here, and specifically as to the medical issues. In this particular case, when was the trial set?
Well, it was initially set in October of 2012, and then the sort of thing that I've learned in my short time here always comes up before trial is new witnesses pop up, people start saying something different, and so we kind of had a new witness pop up in this case, and that caused the trial to be continued until December. Then in December, the defense decided that they were going to possibly use a mental health sort of defense. And when they want to do that, they have to give us notice of that. They hadn't given us the proper notice. That caused another continuance of the trial. So we actually tried it in March of 2013.
Tell us about this witness that came out of the woodwork.
It was a girlfriend maybe of Bradford that had come forward previously and just kind of resurfaced.
Really? That happened often?
Pretty much every case.
Really?
Has been my experience as well. Usually, I think that when we present a case to the grand jury, we have to go through it. We talk to our police officers, we talk to our witnesses, we assemble photographs, things of that nature. I am of the opinion that a lot of defense attorneys won't really look at all this discovery until they're threatened with a trial. And then they start talking to these witnesses, and these issues come up. And invariably, the week before a trial, the status conference before a trial week comes up, these issues pop up. And the 15-month delay in this particular case from arrest to trial is not inconsistent with other cases of a similar nature.
Now, Mr. Livers, during this 15 months, is out, right? Or is he?
He was kind of going in and out. He was in initially and then was released on bond and then went back in because he had committed new offenses and then came back out at some point.
Okay.
Yep. The jail records indicate that he had been in and out of custody about four times since he was arrested on these assault charges. We'll talk about his criminal record after the break, and that's pretty consistent with how he's been acting in the last 10 or 15 years.
And I know the first trial, we haven't gotten this far yet, but in the first trial, had it gone to trial, I did actually go to trial.
It did.
But you can't talk about his record until...
No, sir.
You get, yeah, okay. But then after the verdict and he's found guilty, then you can...
Before then you have the penalty phase.
Yeah, okay, I got you. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959, Touchstar 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. 935, 25 before 10. Sometimes these cases that we talk about, Dan, are more interesting because of what happens trying to get the thing into court than the actual cases themselves. And I mean, if I had been beat senseless as this victim was in this case, I would think it's a very, very important case. And I don't mean to detract from that. But really, the interesting part of this case is the hoops the judge jumped through to come to a conclusion, right?
Once we get to court, you know, at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning and we announce ready for trial, that's the easy part, in my opinion, because by then we've assembled all of our witnesses, we've served subpoenas, we've got records, we've talked to everybody. They're at the courthouse and they're ready to go. There is a lot of work that goes unseen and undiscussed in preparing a significant assault case like this one for trial. So we're at the trial. Can you tell us about how you went through preparing for this case as far as the victim, the medical evidence, and then presenting it to the jury?
Well, we had met with the victim a handful of times, and we had met with the doctor a handful of times. And like Ms. Kinnear was saying, we had only had the ER doctor subpoenaed for the trial initially. And so we began putting on our evidence. We talked all about the stroke. We had the doctor. We hadn't had the doctor on yet, but we had the brother of Mr. Jones talk about the impact that it had had on his life and how he was independent before and how he couldn't live on his own and all of that sort of thing. And that was on Tuesday. Then Wednesday, our very first witness was going to be the ER doctor, and he was going to talk about all of the medical injuries. And the judge called us up to the bench and said, you need to be able to prove that within a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the stroke was caused by the assault. And the defense attorney, in all fairness, probably rightfully objected to us having that come in through the ER doctor. He said, well, you need a neurologist to do that. And we didn't have a neurologist yet. And so it was kind of a struggle to decide what to do at that point.
So what did you do, Tracy?
Well,
we punted.
You know, pretty much. Because the fact of the matter is, all of the real bulk of that testimony had already come in. I mean, the victim had testified, his brother had testified, who had sat through every day of rehab with him. All of the stroke information was already before the jury. And so to now say we have to have this neurologist who we did not have, it was kind of a day late and a dollar short. Mm-hmm. And so, as Dan calls it, we did a do-over. The judge declared a mistrial to give us an opportunity to go back and get the neurologist. Although, you know, the ER doctor certainly was prepared to say, in his medical opinion, that it did cause the stroke.
She wanted another expert that you didn't have available.
Right. Obviously more specialized in that specific area. So,
Send the jury home and you start over, right?
Absolutely. Yep. So we got a new trial date, and we go back and we start tracking down more doctors and doing more work.
And your neurologist that was your expert after the first trial was mistrial, what did that person say about your victim?
Well, that actually threw us for a loop.
Uh-huh.
Because what that doctor ended up saying was they couldn't say with a reasonable degree of medical certainty that the stroke was caused by the assault because they don't know that the stroke caused the paralysis that he suffered, Mr. Jones suffered, because his paralysis was on the right side of his body and the stroke occurred on the right side of his body. That's inconsistent medically. Right side paralysis should come from a left side stroke. And so then we have a whole new question. Then what caused this paralysis? We still felt the assault caused it, but it would have been due to nerve damage in his neck as opposed to the literal stroke. Now, did the nerve damage cause the stroke? Possibly. But the nerve damage would have caused the paralysis. The problem was for the doctor to testify to that, saying that it absolutely came from the assault, we would have had to have had a specialized nerve study done 2 weeks post-trauma, and that had not been done. And so
what do you do in that situation?
You start thinking about a guilty plea, unfortunately.
Offering a deal,
because we couldn't prove, although we still, and I will go to my grave feeling that assault caused every injury that Mr. Jones suffered.
You're shaking your head, Aspen.
My doctor wasn't going to say it.
Absolutely.
And if your doctor won't say it, then you can't prove it.
You can't prove it. Well, that's interesting. And so that wasn't what you wanted, but that's the only option.
Not by a long stretch, no.
Yeah. And so then what happens? Do you contact the defense attorney and say, we got an offer?
Yes.
Right. And that's exactly what we did. And we kind of went back and forth for a little bit until we settled on something that both sides could live with. And it certainly wasn't the outcome that the Commonwealth wanted by any stretch of the imagination. But it was at least a guilty verdict.
Well, when I'm dealing with somebody on a car, I'm going to offer them less than I'm willing to accept, and they're going to ask for more than they're willing to accept. Does it work the same way in this
deal? Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, it does.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there is some old-fashioned sort of, bickering or dealing or whatever. And that happens between who and who?
The attorneys. Between the prosecutor
was
and the
defense. Was that you, Aspen? Was that, who was it? Was it
that
you?
That was both of us. Yeah, both Ms. Kinnear and I.
You sit down face-to-face. You do it on the phone.
A little bit of both. You'll run into the defense attorney walking over to court. You'll call them. He'll call you.
Okay.
Defendant doesn't have anything to do with it. He talks to his client.
Right,
then he comes back.
But the defendant's not in on that. I'm just I just want to technically
not
get in my head.
Not at this stage of things. In a typical case, when once somebody is indicted, we have what's called a pretrial conference with them, and we sit down face-to-face, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the defendant. And that is where we initially present an offer if they want to plead guilty. And that's also their opportunity to tell us anything, really their one and only opportunity to talk directly to the prosecutor and say, this is why I did this, or I want you to consider this fact, because anything that goes on in that pretrial conference discussion cannot be used against them. So that's their chance to talk to us face to face.
I'm trying to think, and this is probably a really stupid question because it's probably can't do it, but in this situation, could you go back and try the defendant on a lesser charge?
We could. I mean, we absolutely, if you take out the serious physical injury element, then it becomes a lesser crime of assault second. The problem in this case was there wasn't a weapon involved. And in order to prove assault second, you either have to have a weapon or you have to have serious physical injury. His weapon were his hands and feet.
Fists and feet.
Those can be weapons if or dangerous instruments if they actually cause a serious physical injury. So it's kind of a catch-22. We couldn't prove serious physical injury, and we can only use his hands and feet as dangerous instruments if they cause serious physical injury. So the danger that we ran was going all the way from assault first to a misdemeanor assault fourth. And that's why we were forced to plead something. We just wanted to be sure that we at least got a felony out of this case.
And a felony would have been first or second?
First or second, what we ultimately pled him to was assault under extreme emotional disturbance.
We'll talk about that when we come back and exactly what that means. That's fascinating, really. And it gives the average person out there some sort of feel for some of the things that you guys are up against. We're going to take a break. 253-5959. Touch *590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere. 1-877-777-0590. 9:46, 14 minutes away from 10 o'clock. News Talk 590 WVLK. Now, this person that was involved in this crime had, you said, a record, a real history of that criminal activity. Can you talk about that?
He sure
a little
is.
Bit?
Mr. Livers is somebody who's very well known to the police and prosecutors here in Fayette County. He's 38 years old, and he started his criminal career in 1996. His overall record is 20 prior convictions, 3 felonies, 17 misdemeanors. 3 of those convictions are assaults that involved physical injury to somebody else, and then one of his felony thefts was a robbery. And I have a memory of that case, of that being an armed robbery of an off-duty police officer.
Really?
That was resolved for evidentiary issues. I believe his brother was involved in that case. And that ended up in a 10-year sentence in 2001. It was a felony theft rather than a robbery, but these are the kind of things that Mr. Livers has been doing since 1996.
And he got 10 years and served what?
Less than that. I'll go through his corrections here in a minute.
Okay.
He served about 3. He was paroled in 2004. He violated, was paroled again in 2006, violated his parole on that occasion. His probation for other crimes was modified on 2 occasions, which is to say the judge didn't revoke him and put him back in, but made him serve a little time or sent him to rehab. His other offenses are narcotics offenses, theft, receiving stolen property. Not surprisingly, very similar to the things that he was involved in that brought him to our attention on this occasion. So he's been in and out of jail. It looks like he's been in and out of our detention center 13 times since 1996. He served out from his first felony conviction, it looks like, in 1999. So he did 3 years. He got his 10-year sentence for that robbery and persistent felony offender charge in 2001, was paroled in 2003, didn't make it, was paroled again in 2005, didn't make it, got new offenses, and was ultimately discharged from his prior service in 2008. So he had been out for a while.
This is such a great example, though, of what Ray talks about all the time and the catch and release and
absolutely
and all that stuff.
And in this particular case, I know I've been here before talking about copper thieves and people that steal out of cars, and we don't like them either, but this man has hurt a lot of people over the years, the last one being this 64-year-old gentleman who was just in his car in the, unfortunately for him, in Mr. Livers' neighborhood.
Okay.
So he is no stranger to the criminal justice system. We've been dealing with him over and over again. One thing, Jack, I did want to say, your car dealer analogy is a good one.
You have to go to Ray with
because
your deal?
Whenever there's a persistent felony offender charge involved, and this has been the rule since I started at the office, we have to go to Ray.
Okay. He's the sales manager.
Exactly.
And he's a tough one.
Yeah.
Because we have to explain to him why the facts don't justify a persistent felony offender charge. Because Ray has said here many times, and I agree, that people like Bradford Livers who commit crimes over and over and over again and get probation and get parole and get state-funded drug treatment and halfway houses and all that sort of thing and respond by coming out of the correctional system and assaulting a dare I say, senior citizen.
Right.
These are the kind of people that we want to put into custody. And so we have to justify to our boss why we're not going to go for a 10 or 20-year violent crime. And in this particular case, as Tracy has explained, had we tried this case again, the odds are pretty good that we would have come away with either an acquittal or a misdemeanor assault.
And what would a misdemeanor assault involve, penalty-wise?
Up to 12 months in the county jail.
Okay, so almost nothing.
Almost nothing, especially for Mr. Livers.
Yeah. So what do you do? What do you sell them to Ray?
I guess I could. These prosecutors can talk about this particular case. The general idea is, if it looks like we're not going to come away with a conviction, we want to negotiate for something.
Right.
Because we're not going to dismiss the charge. I mean, that's just not going to happen. We're routinely asked to do that. Several of our DPA attorneys that we practice with are famous for suggesting misdemeanors every time that we try to talk to them.
Right.
That's a possibility. But if we're going to get, in a case like this, if we're going to get a misdemeanor anyway.
What do you have to lose?
You know, we have nothing to lose, so we might as well try it. Looking at it, in fairness, from the defense point of view, had we tried this case and picked a good jury, or the doctor testified well for us, or the case come out our way, he was looking at assault in the first degree, which is a Class B felony, 10 to 20 years, violent time, 85%. If we got that conviction and then read this record that I summarized for you, the jury would have hung this guy.
Yeah.
So from his point of view, he could be looking at 20 years hard time, you know, 17 and a half
and
years.
And real time.
Yeah.
Real time.
Yeah. So that all kind of factors into this sales procedure. I remember going to the Prosecutor Academy in South Carolina, and one of our instructors, a kind of a famous instructor, came out and he smiled at our class and he said, "I'm sorry, you've all gone into sales." And we all sort of revolted against that, because all of our friends from law school who are doing civil work deal with, you know, insurance settlements and contract negotiations and financial things like
we didn't want to go into that.
That's why I didn't do it.
Right.
I like chasing crooks and putting them in jail.
Exactly. And yeah.
Unfortunately, those principles that we all deal with in purchasing a vehicle or a home, or you know, any sort of
negotiating a contract,
it all comes into play in criminal law as well. So in this particular case, we're faced with some very questionable medical evidence based on the judge's decision to exclude the emergency room doctor's testimony as far as his opinion. We've got the neurologist who's probably not going to back us up, so we have to make a decision.
Aspen, what'd you do?
We ended up pleading the case to assault under extreme emotional disturbance, which is a Class D felony, and we recommended the maximum on that, which was 5 years. And he agreed to that. So that's what he ultimately pled guilty to.
Explain that charge.
Well, extreme emotional disturbance, basically, it doesn't really fit here, but again, it's what you do for negotiation purposes. A true EED case means that I am so enraged or inflamed at some situation or some precipitous event that I basically am just acting out of my mind. I mean, it's the kind of the classic scenario is, you know, somebody walks in on their spouse engaged in an extramarital affair and you just lose it and you do something that's totally out of character and just reactive.
And you don't believe it applies here,
well,
really.
We don't think Mr. Jones did anything to prompt Mr. Livers' behavior other than offend him.
And tell him to get out of his car.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's the only way under our law to get to a Class D assault. There's assault first, which, as we said, was the original charge,
right.
Serious physical injury with the weapon. Assault second would be serious physical injury or a dangerous instrument, deadly weapon with just a physical injury. Next gap is assault fourth misdemeanor.
That's a big gap, too, isn't it?
There's a big gap, right? What's in there under our statutes is assault third. That's what applies to police officers, corrections officials, folks of that nature. So that doesn't apply in this case at all. So, yeah, you take a jump from a Class C felony 5 to 10 years to a misdemeanor 12 months. And the only thing in between there besides that would be this assault under extreme emotional disturbance. And so, you know, we don't like it. It's certainly Mr. Livers deserved a lot more in this case, and Mr. Jones deserved a lot more.
Yeah.
He was not happy with this outcome and any more than we were. But it was better than going to trial and getting a misdemeanor. So sometimes you have to deal with the devil.
And so what will he actually, what kind of time will he actually do?
Well, he has been sentenced. I believe it was October 18th.
Last week he was sentenced,
and the judge decided to put him on probation. So his sentence is 5 years.
What?
Probated for 5 years.
What?
Here is my hope on that. We don't know why the judge makes the decisions that they make necessarily, but in Mr. Liver's situation, your question was, what would he serve?
Right.
If the judge sentenced him to a 5-year sentence to serve, given the jail time credit he already had, he probably would have gone straight to prison, straight to parole, and basically walked right back out the door.
I see.
So the hope is that maybe it's better to have 5 years probation hanging over his head as opposed to him basically walking right on out the door.
Without any supervision or
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so probation sounds horrible, and it was shocking actually initially, but there is another thought process to it, and maybe that's what the judge was thinking.
And if he violates probation, which he likely will, he'll go back in anyway.
Right, exactly.
That's
serve
the
remainder of the 5 years.
That's the theory.
That's the theory.
Okay, guys, great job. Thank you guys for
being
here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack.
Interesting case.